Greetings once again, America. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Glad to have you with us for another week on the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do take the events of the week and focus them through the lens of original thought. And I want to dive right in this week, starting in the international file. Dateline New Delhi, India, from the Agence France-Presse. An Indian man who fathered seven daughters has not washed for 35 years in an apparent attempt to ensure his next child is a boy. You heard that right. 35 years without taking a bath. Kalau Singh, that's the gentleman's name, if one can call such a person a gentleman. Kalau Singh replaces bathing and brushing his teeth with a fire bath every evening when he stands on one leg beside a bonfire, smokes marijuana, and says prayers to Shiva, according... Prayers to Shiva. Okay, so he takes a fire bath. He says, quote, "It's just like using water to take a bath. A fire bath helps kill germs and infection in the body." Yes, that's actual tape. Very good. It's amazing that we're able to get that sound. We have a crack staff here. Now, Kalau is a 63-year-old gentleman from a village outside the holy city of Varanasi. There's a lot of vowels involved there. Varanasi. Now, first of all, what's the holy city of Varanasi? I never heard of this holy city. What's with all these pagan religions and their holy city? They got holy cities. You can't swing a dead cat without hitting a holy city in these pagan countries. And as far as I can recall, there's only one holy city, and that's the city of Jerusalem. But all these pagan religions are just takeoffs on the true religion, the true living God, and the religion professed by his followers. And so anyway, this fairly smelly individual is from a village just outside a holy city. Imagine that, another holy city there in the pagan land of India. Now back to the story. Kalau, who wears two pullovers all through the Indian summer, said his pledge not to wash was a commitment to the national interest. He said, quote, "I'll end this vow only when all problems confronting the nation end." So apparently he's not going to take a bath until all the problems confronting his pagan nation of India end. And I'm sure his neighbors would rather that, you know, he just go the traditional route. Go on a hunger strike, set yourself on fire, please, do anything to get that smell out of the room. Now his neighbors report that a seer once told Kalau that if he does not take a bath, he would be blessed with a male child. Yeah, that's what his neighbors say. Standing in the out-of-doors, I'm sure. Now, in India, most Indians prefer sons to daughters because sons are considered breadwinners, while girls are seen as a burden. According to this article from AFP, they're seen as a burden because of the matrimonial dowry demanded by a groom's family. And folks, this is something that has never made any sense to me. The whole concept of a matrimonial dowry being paid by the father of the bride. Now, perhaps I'm biased because I have three daughters. And in the distant, far-flung future, when some young man decides to ask me for my daughter's hand in marriage, the last thing I'm going to offer this guy is some sort of financial payment in addition to the hand of my daughter. It just doesn't make any sense to me. In fact, I think he's going to have to come up with a sizable bank account, a good job, a car, and at least a down payment on a house before I'll even consider letting him even look at my daughter. So that's never made any sense to me, that's all. Anyway, so this Indian guy, smelly guy outside of a holy city there, what are you going to do? All right, so the story really has no redeeming social value. I just wanted to get it out there about the diary, about the dowry, for any of you guys who are perhaps thinking... Anyone in my circle of friends who's already looking at his son and my daughters And you know, the wheels are turning. I just want you to know where I stand right from the get-go, okay? Not going to be any dowry coming from the McBurney household, I can tell you that. Now, a couple of things. Scanning the television this week, and I must say this has been a fairly depressing news week for me, because it just seems like there's nothing really that drove my interest this week, nothing that really jumped out at me. But I'm scanning the television with my dear wife, and I just want to start off by saying Farrah Fawcett, okay, she's been on TV all week. Apparently, she's at death's door. She's on her last leg. She's dying of cancer. And I sincerely hope that Farrah Fawcett, having been given fair warning that she's about to cross over to the other side, I do indeed hope she finds Jesus Christ and acknowledges him as Creator and Lord. I really do hope so. But what I'm annoyed about is the secular news media insists every time they tell the story of Farrah Fawcett and her brave battle against cancer, they have to show the poster from 1970-whatever. You all know the poster that made Farrah famous. You all know the poster, right? Why do they have to show the poster? I mean, Farrah's on death's door. But the news media, well, there's a reason. That poster sold. And it continues to sell, even amidst the story of great tragedy as Farrah lies on her deathbed. The news media still wants to put that poster out there for everyone to see. And it's just disturbing to me and disturbing to my wife, frankly, as we're sitting there just trying to watch the news. We're just trying to catch up on the events of the day, maybe catch a little weather, and they've got to show that. But Farrah, if you're listening, and there's absolutely no chance that you are listening, but perhaps someone is listening who will let you know that you're about to meet Jesus Christ and you'll want to meet him on good terms, and the first thing you're going to want to do is apologize for that poster. All right, now we were scanning along also late night television. After we get the kids to bed, my wife and I have maybe an hour or two of time where we can sit and pretend we're adults. And so we scan a little news and we generally make fun of people and we make comments on the general progress of the culture as it circles the drain toward the ultimate vortex of Hades and fire. And we happened to cross one Marshall Mathers Jr., who is apparently on the comeback tour. This is a young hip-hop artist who came to fame sometime in the 90s, from what I understand, as a white hip-hop rapper from Detroit. My wife watched him for about 18 seconds on Jay Leno or Letterman, I forget, one of those late-night empty suits. And after about 18 seconds, my wife turned to me and she said, of Marshall Mathers III, she said, he's not very bright, is he? That pretty much sums it up. I mean, there's not much more you could say. And it only took her 18 seconds to discern that, and she didn't even know who the guy was. Anyway, also, one other thing. Has there been a DNA test to prove that Ellen DeGeneres and Anderson Cooper are not indeed the same person? Because I saw an interview, just brief few seconds of an interview, with Anderson Cooper and Ellen DeGeneres, and I suspect camera trickery. Because when you really start to look at these two, it's disturbing how similar they look. And from what I understand, they both like boys. Oh, no, wait, Ellen doesn't like boys. Aha! That's it. That's how they perpetrate the fraud. Anyway, I want our crack DNA staff to look into that, because I need to know. And America deserves to know. All right, now let's jump back in to the events of the week. Here at the Weekly Worldview, we take the events of the week, we focus them through the lens of original thought, and we're going to dive into the international file from the Reuters Wire. And this relates back to our story of the smelly Indian guy who wants a son. Swedish health authorities have ruled that gender-based abortion is not illegal according to current Swedish law and cannot therefore be stopped. Yeah. Swedish television reported in February that a woman from, I don't know if I can pronounce this, Eskilstuna in southern Sweden had twice had abortions after finding out the gender of her child. The woman, who already had two daughters, requested an amniocentesis in order to allay concerns about a possible chromosome abnormality. At the same time, she also asked to know the fetus's gender. And two abortions were performed. Well, the health board there in Sweden, where they have socialized, nationalized health care, socialized medicine, the health board there has now responded to an inquiry from bureaucrats in the National Health Service, or whatever they call it over there. Bureaucrats who had gone saying, can women ask about the gender when we suspect that they may be considering an abortion? Well, the board has responded that such requests and thus abortions cannot be refused, and that it is not possible to deny a woman an abortion, even if the fetus's gender is the basis for that request. And certain pro-choice Americans may express some shock over that. Well, I mean, I'm for choice, but to have an abortion over gender, that's just beyond the pale. And I ask, is it really? Once you pass a law, any law, that denies the personhood of a certain class of citizen, there then is nowhere you can draw the line in making the killing of that class of persons illegal. You can't do it. You've undermined their fundamental personhood, and from thence there is no return. So there you have Sweden, and none of us are shocked at that, right? That Sweden's on its way down, but it happens every day here in the good old U.S. of A. as well, I can assure you. Now, on to the politics file. We're going to talk a little bit about Barry Ho, because Barry Ho's big in the news this week. He's out at Notre Dame University, and according to a story from Reuters, no, I'm sorry, this is from CNN, having already mentioned Anderson Cooper and my suspicions about him. Let's see. Barry Ho, that's our term of endearment for our wonderful president, Barack Hussein Obama. I find it a term that aptly captures both the truth of his middle and last names, his African-American heritage, and his connection to the Hawaiian heritage. Good old Barry Ho was addressing a sharply divided audience at the storied Catholic University, according to CNN, and in his speech, Obama conceded that no matter how much Americans may want to fudge it on the issue of abortion, at some level, the views of the two camps are irreconcilable. That's what Barry Ho said. The views of the two camps are irreconcilable. But he said, quote, each side will continue to make its case to the public with passion and conviction, but surely we can do so without reducing those with differing views to caricature. And Barry's got some nerve addressing this issue there at Notre Dame in the midst of this great controversy, which brings me to the conclusion that Barry Ho has some nerve. The guy has some nerve, and he's a man that we must be careful of, nay, fear, possibly. Possibly he's a man who should be feared. He's a man who gets things done. He's an administrator. He's not afraid of controversy. In fact, I predict that as the national personhood movement builds, at that time when we win in a state, perhaps a southern state, perhaps a conservative state, perhaps a small, less populated state, a personhood initiative passes, granting, reestablishing the personhood of the unborn child, that Barry Ho will not be afraid to stand up and say, yes, I know it's a child, I want to kill it anyway. Barry Ho will be that man. Now, out at Notre Dame, that was big news this week. 27 people were arrested prior to Obama's speech, according to CNN, and Norma McCorvey, who was the plaintiff identified as Roe in the Roe versus Wade decision, was among those arrested, along with Alan Keyes, Randall Terry. A number of high-profile pro-life individuals were arrested out there. And I just can't, I'm going to say it, and if it offends some of you folks who have taken this issue to heart, I'm sorry. But it just seems to me that protesting an unregenerate sinner in a completely degenerate institution simply strikes me as redundant. I'm glad that we had brothers and sisters out there. I'm glad that they were willing to be arrested. But Barry Ho is pretty far gone. The Catholic Church is way, way far gone. Notre Dame is simply, Catechism at Notre Dame is not nearly as popular as the beer bong, for crying out loud. It's Notre Dame. It's a party school at this point. It's yet another institution that has degenerated beyond our ability to bring it back. So for all of you folks out there protesting, I honor your energy, and I ask you to channel it with me in the coming months and years toward personhood. Is that supposed to be a guitar solo? Bring that up. Up. Okay, all right. Well, you know, that's what happened in the 90s, ladies and gentlemen. The guitar solo simply disappeared. It's just sad. Anyway, now, in case you were wondering about the state of the Catholic Church, Catholicism, and the Catholic institution in general, Dateline Bethlehem from the International File from the Associated Press. Standing in the cradle of Christianity, Pope Benedict XVI told Palestinians this Wednesday past that he understands their suffering and offered his strongest public backing yet for an independent Palestinian state. The Pope also called for a Palestinian homeland, you'll remember, when he arrived in Israel during his most recent trip to the Middle East. So there you have it. I mean, I suppose we can cut him some slack because he was surrounded by people who basically wanted to chop his head off, but still, he's the Pope. He needs to stand up and say that Jerusalem is the eternal, indivisible capital of the Hebrew people. Let me just put it that way. And it's just a shame when your church has fallen and degraded to the point where its leadership is simply spineless and myopic. It doesn't know right from wrong. It sounds like I'm talking about the pro-life movement, for crying out loud. It's just embarrassing. All right, now back to Barry Ho, who has some things to say on the economy this year that may surprise you. From the Bloomberg Wire, President Barry Ho called current deficit spending unsustainable, and he warned of skyrocketing interest rates for consumers if the U.S. continues to finance government by borrowing from other countries. This guy has got some nerve. He's the one borrowing all the money. He's the one crafting the legislation that is bankrupting our nation and mortgaging our grandchildren. While he's writing the legislation and pushing it through the Congress, he has the nerve to stand up and say, by the way, this is unsustainable. Unsustainable indeed, Mr. Ho, for crying out loud. Here's what Ho had to say. We can't keep on borrowing from China. We have to pay interest on that debt, and that means we are mortgaging our children's future with more and more debt, as he wrote the rubber check right there. I mean, the guy's got some nerve. Now, earlier in the week, according to the Bloomberg Wire report, the Obama administration revised its own budget estimates and raised the projected deficit for this year to $1.84 trillion. Let's just round it off. It's $2 trillion. $2 trillion. Anyway, he was down in New Mexico. And he pledged to work with Congress to shore up entitlement programs. Now, he just told us this is unsustainable. And in the same speech, he says he's going to shore up entitlement programs such as Social Security and Medicare. And he also said he was confident that the House and Senate would pass a health care overhaul bill by August that will surely destroy the nation. Anyway, the guy's got some nerve. And now, last week I talked about governmental oversight of all this bailout money and all the rubber checks that these guys are writing up there. From Fox News TV in New York, this week, thousands of people are getting stimulus checks in the mail. The problem is that a lot of them are dead. Yeah. But federal officials estimate, now these are federal bureaucrats from the Social Security Administration, they estimate between 8 and 10,000 checks for millions and millions of dollars went out to dead people, and they blame a rushed schedule because all the checks have to be cut by June, and they had no explanation for the fact that some of the checks were made out to people who were never even a part of the Social Security system. They had no explanation. My guess is they were on some Acorn database somewhere, and everyone on that database got a check. I mean, folks, years from now, when we find out where all this money went, it's simply going to be shocking. That's if we get there. If the whole country isn't just consumed in strife and civil unrest due to crushing economic burden being put upon us by people who've said this economy is simply too big to fail. I just don't get it. Oh, but here you go. Did you ever take your civil service test? No? Well, you're going to be sorry. The headline from CNN, it's a good time to work for Uncle Sam. That's right. According to CNN, although the official unemployment rate is nearing double digits, the U.S. government is on a hiring binge. Executive branch employment, listen to this, folks, employment in the executive branch of the federal government, and this is excluding the Postal Service and the Defense Department, is set to increase between 15 and 25% this year. The Homeland Security Department, the Justice Department, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission are on track for 15 to 25% increases in employment. And meanwhile, the homeland is less secure. There is no justice. There's no justice system. There's just a system. And the nuclear threat, does that seem any better? To me, it seems outlandishly increased, even since last week. Well, we probably just need to hire some more people to take care of that stuff. Meanwhile, Mohammed El-Baradei is warning from the international file of a new nuclear age. This is from The Guardian, which is a paper there in the United Kingdom. Mohammed El-Baradei said the threat of nuclear proliferation is particularly grave in the Middle East. Wow, give this guy a raise. He's a genius. Yeah, he says that the number of potential nuclear weapon states could more than double in just a few years unless the major powers take radical steps toward disarmament. Did you catch that? Do you think he's talking about disarming the potential nuclear states? No, no. Mohammed El-Baradei is talking about the United States disarming, and Russia, too. He wants us to disarm, and that will somehow encourage the madmen in the Middle East to disarm as well. The current international regime limiting the spread of nuclear weapons was in danger of falling apart under its own inequity. That's right, he says, the whole thing's falling apart. Now, the article tells us that Baradei himself has presided over the IAEA for more than 11 years. So he's basically saying, you know, I dropped the ball here. The whole world is on the verge of nuclear destruction, and my agency is about to collapse. By the way, I ran that agency for 11 years. Could I get my 2.5% cost of living increase in my pension this year? On a more serious note, El-Baradei predicted that the next wave of proliferation would involve, quote, virtual nuclear weapon states, unquote, who produce plutonium or highly enriched uranium and possess the know-how to make warheads, but who stop just short of assembling a weapon. They would therefore remain technically compliant with the non-proliferation treaties while being within a couple of months of deploying and using a nuclear weapon. This is the phenomenon we see now and what people worry about in Iran, says El-Baradei. And this phenomenon goes much beyond Iran. Pretty soon, you'll have 9 weapon states and probably another 10 or 20 virtual weapon states. So nice job, Mohammed. We really appreciate you running the IAEA and all the good work you've done there and how close you've brought us to the precipice of nuclear destruction. Thank you very much. All right, now speaking of the eve of destruction, I've got a story from the Associated Press regarding one Edward M. Kennedy. Yes, Dateline Boston from the Associated Press. Between doctor's appointments, Edward Kennedy has been working the phones, urging Senate colleagues to pass a health care bill. He's trying to finish his memoirs, and he's overseeing the design of a namesake building to stand next to his brother's presidential library. A year after being diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, praise the Lord and hallelujah, the 77-year-old last surviving Kennedy brother has defied some doctors' expectations and worked steadily to cement his personal and political legacies. Yes. So, Edward M. Kennedy, victim of terminal brain cancer, still hard at work doing the work of his Lord. Doing the work of the devil. Yeah, just a month after brain surgery, Kennedy returned triumphantly to the Senate. You remember, he cast the dramatic and decisive vote on a Medicare bill. Then in January, Kennedy donned a fedora and fulfilled his promise to attend Barry Hoe's inauguration as president. Now, Kennedy is writing a memoir, and it's called, the title of Kennedy's memoir, now this is just a working title, is, quote, True Compass. True Compass is Edward M. Kennedy's, the working title for his memoir. It's scheduled to come out this fall. True Compass. He obviously didn't have a true compass that night in Chappaquiddick. And I wonder if he'll mention that in the book. Well, he may not have time, ladies and gentlemen, because he's not just working on his memoir. He's also been completing a final phase of an oral history project for the University of Virginia, and he's monitoring the design of the Edward M. Kennedy Institute, which will seek to do some furtherance of the work of Satan and Lucifer and his minions. So how much nerve does this guy have working on monitoring the design of a building that's named after him? You'd think he'd have the decency to die first before he let somebody name a building after him, for crying out loud. Anyway, Edward M. Kennedy continues, and it's just sad. All right, now speaking of things despicable and people who do the work for the forces of darkness, Dateline New York City from the Associated Press, former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan has been named a Columbia University Global Fellow and is expected to give lectures, host conferences, and moderate events at the Ivy League school. Annan also, according to the Associated Press, strangely enough, Annan also leads the Kofi Annan Foundation and is chairman of the Alliance, and he's a chairman of the board for the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. And isn't that just delightful? Mr. Kofi Annan heads a foundation named after Mr. Kofi Annan. Because after all, when you're working for the devil, I mean, you sign the contract, he gets your soul, you get buildings and institutions, foundations named after you. You get all the worldly glory that you can accumulate to yourself before your soul descends eternally into the pit of hell. The Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. Interesting. I didn't know they had a problem with going green in Africa. I thought they had a problem with getting electricity to people's houses in Africa. I didn't know they had a problem with going green. But apparently, Mr. Annan wants to lead a green revolution in Africa, maybe to offset all those blood-red revolutions that have been happening for the past, 200 years or so. Anyway, Kofi. Kofi makes his way back into the news. Kofi rears his ugly head again. Boy, is that depressing. All right, now I got the justice file. We're going to dive into the justice file briefly. And the justice file is very thin this week, I am sorry to say, ladies and gentlemen. But we do have a couple of interesting headlines. Dateline McAllister, Oklahoma. A man convicted of battering his girlfriend's 8-year-old son and stuffing the body in a freezer was put to death last Thursday in Oklahoma. That's right. Let's see here. Also, a man in Alabama was executed for fatally stabbing a mother of six. I want to talk about this guy from Oklahoma, Donald Lee Gilson. He was 48 years old when he met the Lord this week. Now, he proclaimed his innocence in the death of the 8-year-old Shane Kaufman before he was injected in Oklahoma City with a lethal but quite comfortable combination of drugs. And here's what he said, quote, "I am an innocent man, but I'll get to go to heaven, and I'll see Shane tonight." That's what he said in his final statement. He was pronounced dead just after 6 p.m. And the guy's got a point here. I don't know about him being innocent. We'll sort that out on Judgment Day. But he will get to go somewhere tonight, and he will have an opportunity to see Shane. And the Lord will surely introduce him to Shane, and he'll have an opportunity to be judged by the one he killed, if indeed he's guilty. And it's not like we'll never know. We will know. We will know on Judgment Day. But that's it for the justice file, ladies and gentlemen. Two executions. How many murders this week? I'm not sure. I would guess there's more than a couple. And that's just sad that there's such a there's such a disconnect between the number of executions and the number of murders and kidnappings that are going on in the country on a daily basis, as we report to you from the domestic tranquility file, which we will get into in just a moment. But first, back to the culture file. A mother has been charged in Manatee County, Florida, with neglecting her daughter's teeth. Now listen to this. Police say a mother neglected to provide her child with needed dental care, which led to severe tooth decay, and the mother was arrested on a felony neglect charge. Yeah, she apparently had taken the child to a dentist who told her that the child had bottle mouth. Now, I'd never heard of this before, but bottle mouth is apparently tooth decay common in infants and toddlers. And anyway, her Medicaid coverage wouldn't pay for the treatment, so she didn't seek the treatment. Apparently, the father is missing in action, and he's not coming up with the dough to fix the kid's teeth. So, naturally, the smart thing for the government to do is to put this mother in jail, which is what they've done. It's just unbelievable. I'm not sure how you solve this problem. I'm not going to get into that because I don't have time to solve it. But I don't think taking the mother and throwing her in jail is necessarily going to help the kid with her dental problems. Perhaps there would have been a more creative way to solve that problem. Anyway, the mother sits in jail. The kid's got bottle mouth, rotten teeth. Speaking of rotten teeth and a mouth that would make you sick, Dateline London from the United Kingdom's Daily Mail, Madonna and her toy boy lover Jesus are set to tie the knot in a Kabbalah ceremony any day now. That's right. Now, the boyfriend's father, the boy toy, as the Daily Mail calls him, his name is Jesus. The boy toy's father says that his son is very happy and that this ceremony, this Kabbalah ceremony, would just confirm that. He says, I don't know if there will be an actual wedding. From what I've read, there could be some sort of ritual, but I don't know Kabbalah. I don't know if it's valid. I don't know if it's legal. But I'm very, very happy that my son is going to marry Madonna or have a ceremony with her or, you know, whatever. It's very nice. My son is very, very happy. Now, the boyfriend's father says he has spoken to Madonna, and he says she is very pleasant. He says, we've already spoken on the phone, and she seems like a normal person. She's calm. She's feminine. I didn't feel any harshness. She was very polite. And he adds that his son is not one to be easily taken by money and glamour. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if he'd be so easily taken if he really got a chance to look into Madonna's mouth. This idea, ladies and gentlemen, of trying to ponder or contemplate perhaps what Madonna has put in her mouth over the years, as disturbing as that might be, it brings me back to the story this week. Apparently, the powers that be there at Focus on the Family have decided that they would not have a problem if Barry Ho decides to appoint a homosexual to the Supreme Court. Because, hey, we don't care if he's a homosexual as long as he's a good judge. And I'm thinking, you know, if you can't judge what you put in your mouth, how can you possibly be a Supreme Court? Okay, we'll just leave that aside. That probably went a bit too far, but you understand what I mean. Now, speaking of the flood from the closet, Dateline Concord, New Hampshire, from the Associated Press, Governor John Lynch said Thursday he'll sign a bill to make his state the sixth to legalize gay marriage. And by that, they don't mean happy marriage. No, they mean homosexual marriage. Yes, that's right. He says he'll sign the bill as soon as the legislature makes some changes, which legislative leaders immediately said they would make. They fell all over themselves saying, Governor, we will make those changes. Now listen to what Lynch asked for. He asked that the already approved legislation be revised to better protect churches and their employees against lawsuits if said church's beliefs preclude them from marrying homosexuals. And now they're not saying that if you're a Christian and you refuse to marry a homosexual that you might go to jail. They haven't gone that far yet. They're saying if you're a Christian minister and you refuse to perform the ceremony for two other degenerate people, then we want to protect you. We want to protect your bad behavior because you're just not with it. You don't get it. You're not enlightened. You haven't seen the rainbow light given off by the homosexual movement as it blurs past, skidding down the hill on its way to hell. You haven't seen the light, but we understand it's because you're Christians. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is yet another small step in the criminalization of Christianity. And, of course, folks from the gay marriage supporters up there in New Hampshire, they say they do not object to changing the language, labeling Christians, basically saying, look, we'll tolerate the Christians for now. We understand that they're bigots and they're hateful and that they all should be shot and piled into a mass grave, but for now, we'll tolerate their Neanderthal beliefs in that they don't want to marry homosexuals. Yeah. Now, this governor out there in New Hampshire, he says he personally opposes gay marriage, but he decided to view the issue through a broader lens. Yeah, broader lens. He's on that broad road, that broad path, right, isn't he? You've read the scripture. Narrow is the path that leads to eternal life, and broad is the way that leads to destruction. Governor John Lynch is on the broad path, and he openly admits it right here in this. He's quoted by the Associated Press, and we'll be sure I'm going to tick mark that so we can bring that up on Judgment Day, Mr. Lynch. That's right. We'll all be there. Okay. Now, let's see. Was there anything left in this story that I may want to comment on? The executive director of the New Hampshire Freedom to Marry Coalition, a group supporting gay marriage, has approved of Lynch's changes, labeling Christians as barely tolerable cavemen for the moment. She says, her name is Mo, so, you know, go wherever you want with that. She says, this is language we can support. Yeah, I'll bet. So much for New England, right? Yeah, we've been following that for a few weeks now. New England is... Rhode Island's going to be the last holdout there. We'll see how long they can last. Dateline, Madison, Wisconsin, again from the Culture File. The Wisconsin Supreme Court agreed this past week to decide whether the state's 2006 ban on gay marriage was properly put to voters. So the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the voters of Wisconsin, voted for an amendment banning homosexual marriage. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court has said, wait just a minute. We want to take another look at this and decide whether or not that was put properly to the voters. And so it's an appropriate dateline, Madison, Wisconsin. They're on their way. Yeah, Madison, Wisconsin. It used to be Wisconsin was famous for cheese, and now it's famous for degeneracy and flamboyant, flagrant liberalism that will culminate in homosexual weddings right there on the main street of Madison, Wisconsin. When the Supreme Court decides that they're going to take a second look at something like this, I can assure you that that look will not end up being a favorable one if you're a person like myself who sits on the right, or if you're a person who generally knows right from wrong. You're not going to like what comes out of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So just brace yourself, okay? Brace yourself. It's on the way. Now let's move across the Midwest. Deeper into the Culture File, Dateline, Detroit, and this is a story out of Troy, Michigan. 7 months ago, officials gathered for a ribbon-cutting ceremony to celebrate a $900,000 house owned by the city of Troy that was to be used as an educational tool and meeting spot. It was supposed to be a shining example of the green movement. It's a completely independent solar-powered house with no gas or electrical hookups. That's right. The sad part is, folks, that the house never opened to the public. It remains closed. Frozen pipes during the winter caused damage to the floors. And the city officials say it's not. They don't think it's safe there. And they're not sure when the house at the Troy Community Center will actually open. Now, students at the Lawrence Technological University, students built the 800-square-foot home. Wait a minute, 800 square feet $900,000. Wow. And this isn't Beverly Hills, is it? No, this is Troy, Michigan. I wonder what the median home price in Troy, Michigan is. I wonder what the price of an 800-square-foot house is there in Troy. Well, I guess if you want to go green, it's 900 grand. And then your pipes burst. Anyway, the home was supposed to be livable year-round and free from the grid, the electrical grid, and it was supposed to churn out enough solar power to support a home-based business and an electrical vehicle, but apparently they couldn't even figure out a way to keep the pipes from bursting. So they've got some work to do there, like so much of the green movement. They have a little work ahead of them. Let's see here. How did all this happen? The superintendent of the parks for the city said the flooding occurred from a glitch in the heater. He says, quote, the system was designed to kick a heater on to keep water from freezing. But the heater drew all the reserve power out of the battery, and it caused the system to back down. And once the battery was drained, guess what? The pipes broke. It's Troy, Michigan, for crying out loud. Anyway, just a sad, sad setback for our brothers and sisters in the green movement. But we'll wish them the best, and I'm sure they're going to figure out that whole solar and wind thing real soon. I know that the government's investing quite a bit of my money into it, and so I certainly hope they get all that figured out. All right, now, let's go back to the culture file. Dateline Dickinson, North Dakota, from the Associated Press. North Dakota's Board of Higher Education has agreed to drop the University of North Dakota's Fighting Sioux nickname and Indian Head logo, a move intended to resolve a decades-long campus dispute about whether the name demeans American Indians. Wait a minute, the Associated Press used the term American Indians? That right there is demeaning. I mean, how the term American Indians makes it into an Associated Press story anymore is beyond me. I mean, I thought that was one of the tenets of getting a communications or a journalism degree, was that you would never use the term American Indians, and that you'll never start a sentence with and. Those two things. We're going to be looking for further violations here in this article, but they've used the term American Indians. Right there, they've demeaned all the wonderful Native Americans who built this great nation after Europeans showed them how to make a wheel. Yeah. Let's see. Now, the name and the logo for the Fighting Sioux, it's a profile of an Indian, a profile of an Indian's face. There it is again, an American Indian. They did it again. Boy, these people are not very sensitive. Let's see. The logo is a profile of an American Indian man with feathers and streaks of paint on his face. Now, the logo could still be saved. Now, get this, ladies and gentlemen. You'll have to pay attention here. The logo could still be saved if North Dakota's Standing Rock and Spirit Lake Sioux tribes agree by October 1st to give the university permission to use them. Isn't that interesting? So this issue isn't resolved. The Sioux nations there, the tribes, could somehow give the university permission to continue using this demeaning and degrading logo for the Fighting Sioux. And tribal officials say that possibility is remote. It's remote, according to tribal officials. And do you want to guess how remote it is? Well, let's say, for example, that the university was to arrange for some zoning for a particular casino in a particular area where tax-free tobacco and liquor could be sold. Well, tribal elders then would have to get 'em powwow and smoke 'em peace pipe and consider the possibility that perhaps this logo isn't quite as demeaning as they may have thought initially before they were given permission to build that casino and to sell that tax-free liquor, tobacco, and gasoline. So the folks up there at the North Dakota's Board of Higher Education, they've got some negotiating to do. There's some work to be done here, but my guess is, that's right, my guess is that the Fightin' Sioux logo lives on for many, many moons. the Weekly Worldview. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. What is that, like some Native American guitar in that song? That was wild. All right, we want to thank our very, very attractive audio engineer for her bumper selection this evening, which is just wonderful. And we're going to dive back in. Let's see here. I suppose we'll do the domestic tranquility file. And, you know, I just realized that I forgot my scripture for the week. Isn't that terrible? I had decided I was going to try to slip at least one scripture into every episode of the Weekly Worldview. And I know I may have obliquely quoted some scripture earlier, but I'm going to make a reminder here that I need to do better with that. You know, don't we all need to do better with that? We were just discussing, we had a men's meeting, some of the guys from our church getting together, and we all admitted that there are times when we come home from church and we throw our Bible up on the table there, on the desk, in the foyer, wherever, and it stays there until next Sunday. And that's not good. No, it's not. So I'm putting a reminder here that I need to work harder on that. Working. It just doesn't seem to work for me. I don't know. All right, but let's go into the domestic tranquility file. I will bring you two scriptures next week, and I can assure you they will be controversial. Okay? Two scriptures next week. Writing a note right here. Okay. Now, into the domestic tranquility file. If you're not aware of it, ladies and gentlemen, your government has failed you in their most fundamental responsibility to ensure domestic tranquility and that you're safe in your home and that you're not attacked, mauled, murdered, killed, burned, stabbed, or shot by criminals. And the government is failing every day on a grander and grander scale. Dateline Albuquerque, New Mexico. Days after the body of a small boy was found buried in the sand at a city park playground, investigators are focused on trying to find the child's relatives. A small boy was found buried in the sand at a city park in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Now, a preliminary autopsy provided no immediate clues as to how the 3 to 5-year-old child died. There were no obvious signs of the cause of death, according to officials. Police had received no reports of missing children in the 24 hours before the discovery. Forensic experts told police the boy could not have been dead longer than 48 hours. So, shocking news from Albuquerque in the domestic tranquility file. Dateline, Tijuana, Mexico. The bodies of 4 U.S. citizens were found strangled, beaten, and stabbed in a van 2 days after they reportedly left their Southern California homes for a night at the Mexican clubs. A spokesman for the Chula Vista Police Department said a friend told the women... Now, this was... Two men and two women. And a spokesman for the Chula Vista Police Department said a friend told the women's parents they were headed to nightclubs in Tijuana this Thursday night past, and they were reported missing the next day when they didn't answer their cell phones. They've been found strangled, beaten, and stabbed. No doubt in relation to the drug war. Well, actually, there is some doubt because people are found beaten, stabbed, and strangled in vans and other conveyances on this side of the border, on that side of the border, every day of the week, for crying out loud. It's an epidemic. In fact, I'm going to move to the culture file. This story just struck me as odd. I'm going to go through it and see if it means anything to anyone. Dateline Portland, Maine. Several juveniles and adults faced charges following a melee that began when police stopped and arrested a shoplifting suspect and an unruly crowd gathered. Police responded to a report that a man had stolen 2 bottles of vodka. Workers at the store provided a description of the suspect and the car he left in. Police pulled that car over a couple of minutes later. As they were arresting the suspect, a crowd began to gather around the police making the arrest, and members of the gathering group, some of who are Sudanese, like the man being arrested, and some of who are from other African countries, began calling the officers names, including killers and murderers, in apparent reference to the police shooting of a Sudanese immigrant last month. Interesting. Now, 5 people were arrested, 2 of them on charges of assault after they allegedly punched the police officers. Police say they had to use pepper spray in making the arrests. The shift commander reported that additional arrests were warranted, but officers opted not to arrest others so the confrontation would not escalate. I don't know. This could have been out of the domestic tranquility file. I mean, you got police trying to arrest a shoplifter getting beat up by an angry crowd and basically on the verge of a riot, and the police are afraid to escalate force because they're afraid the whole situation will escalate. And it's a shame, ladies and gentlemen, when we tolerate crime to the point where the police are as overwhelmed as they are right now. The police are simply so overwhelmed right now in major metropolitan areas that they have a tendency to kill innocent people because they're basically they're scared for their lives in a lot of situations. And the fact that our government has tolerated a level of crime that puts police in this situation should make all of us fearful for our safety, because the police, they're that thin blue line, you know, between anarchy, chaos, crime, and civility and civilization. And when the police are stressed to the point where you've got them not being able to tell the good guys from the bad guys anymore, for crying out loud, you've got to worry about the future of the country. Needless to say, and I'm going to mention this, we're allowing these foreigners to come into our country and basically form communities that are completely cut off from the outside world. And in doing so, we condemn these communities to second-class citizenship. And we set ourselves up for situations where tribalism tends to take over in the urban areas. And it's quite frightening and disturbing. And a better government would do a better job. First of all, in ensuring that criminals are afraid to commit crimes. That would solve so many of the problems related to everything I've mentioned, that everything I've mentioned would be fairly trivial if the government would just do that. Ensure that criminals are afraid to commit crimes by letting every criminal know that punishment shall be swift and it shall be severe. If they would just do that, these other problems would... You know, that's probably why, you know, you have Chinatown in New York, a huge Chinatown out in San Francisco that, you know, they developed 100 years ago, 150 years ago. And even though these were insular communities, there wasn't this tribalism and this sense that they were fighting the white man. They just developed their fairly insular communities, but they did connect themselves to the outside world. And there was some assurance of justice in these communities. And there wasn't rampant crime and criminality and bloodshed in the streets that sets people on edge and makes tribalism a problem. Anyway, that's just my sociological theory for the week. All right. Back into the domestic tranquility file. Dateline New York City. A young lady named Nimze Aponte met a man named Raymond Dennis via AOL, but ultimately she refused to meet him face to face. He responded by stabbing her in broad daylight as she sat with a friend on a park bench in the Bronx. Aponte died a short time after the attack. The stabbing highlights a growing phenomenon, major crimes connected to online social networks. A New York City Police Department spokesman said, quote, "This is a phenomenon that is with us. This is the world in which we live. People have to take reasonable precautions." And I would posit the idea, ladies and gentlemen, that the modern online social networks are no different than any other social network. It's just like when people first started getting telephones 100 years ago. You know, talking on the internet is not that much different than talking on the telephone. It's not that the internet is the problem. It's not that social networking is a problem. The problem is the government tolerates a level of crime that is simply unacceptable. And criminals have no fear, so a guy gets upset because a girl won't go out with him, and he stabs her to death. Why? He sees it happen all the time. People shoot, stab, burn, and kill other people because they've offended them. And our government seems to tolerate it, so he did it. He's not a good problem solver. And the government needs to make sure that stupid people who are not capable of solving their problems outside of violence are afraid to do so. That's all. It's not Facebook's fault or AOL's fault or Craigslist's fault or anybody's fault besides the government. And by the way, here in America, we the people, we're the government. Why are we tolerating all this crime? Are we that nice, really? I suppose we're so nice that we're gonna all get killed. We're so nice. Unbelievable. Now, in a related story from London, a German office worker was found guilty Monday of the savage murder of a British man whose girlfriend he had become obsessed with after they met on a website. David Heiss stabbed Matthew Pike 86 times in a brutal attack after traveling from Germany and forcing his way into the couple's apartment. Now, the court who found him guilty had heard that the killer had become infatuated with the victim's girlfriend through a War Games website the couple ran together from their apartment. So, of course, they tolerate this level of insanity in Europe as well. And so people get offended, people get obsessed, people get into immoral situations with other people's wives, and before you know it, somebody ends up stabbed 86 times. It's just, it's not the internet's fault, though. It's really not. Okay. One more from the Domestic Tranquility File. Authorities say Chicago man kidnapped and assaulted two women and teenage girls over a 12-hour span, playing Russian roulette with one of the women and letting his pit bull attack them. Authorities say the victims are three sisters, and the man is the boyfriend of one of the sisters' mother. So that's domestic tranquility for you. All right. Let's end on a lighter note. Dateline Atlanta, Georgia. The nonprofit group Habitat for Humanity announced a $100 million donation it received. It's the largest individual contribution in the history of Habitat for Humanity. And Habitat says it will help them build 60,000 homes around the globe. Now, I crunched the math on this. That's only $1,700 per house. But if you've ever seen a Habitat for Humanity house, you wouldn't even pay $1,700 for it. And you got a bunch of morons tacking this thing together with staples and cardboard, and they feel so good about themselves. The donation came from Ronald Terwilliger, a former housing developer who also owns the Atlanta WNBA franchise, the Atlanta Dream. Okay, well, I don't know if that explains anything or... Dateline Columbia, South Carolina. A Clarendon County waitress is accused of shooting a customer at a restaurant after the two had a dispute. Yakisha Ward is charged with assault and battery with intent to kill. She shot Crystal Samuel at the Waffle House there in Columbia, South Carolina. Now, there was an argument, and that's when it got ugly. Samuel says she threw a waffle at the waitress. She says, "I did actually throw some food, but it didn't hit her." That's when she jumped across the counter and we got into it. Yeah. Now, the altercation continued outside where Ward got a gun from her car. And now, I mean, you get a waffle thrown at you. Let's think about an escalation of force. I mean, the waffle didn't even hit the lady, for crying out loud. Anyway, the sheriff there says it was poor judgment on the part of Yakisha Ward trying to settle this matter with a weapon. Police say Ward's gun discharged during the altercation. They say a bullet fragment struck the other woman in the arm. Deputies were close by when they rolled up to the parking lot. The victim and the suspect were still engaged in a fight. And before it ended, authorities say that Ward struck the victim in the head with a gun. Fortunately, ladies and gentlemen, no one was killed, and business at the Waffle House was relatively unaffected. Because apparently things like this happen fairly regularly at the Waffle House. And so just be careful about where you decide to go for that late night waffle snack. All right, I want to thank all my friends who helped keep the broadcast on the air. Folks at American Right to Life, KGov Radio, Denver Bible Church, our good friends at Personhood USA, and of course, our internet brethren at Theology Online, and as always, my other brother Daryl for making it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll be back with you next week. Until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.